Welcome to Measured Impact, where we share behind-the-scenes stories of the world's leading mission-driven companies. Because when it comes to activism, brand building, and revenue growth, we believe profits and purpose aren't mutually exclusive. Let's dive in. And today on Measured Impact, we are joined by Seth Laxman, advocacy and activism campaigner at Lush Cosmetics North America. Seth brings an experienced background in professional advocacy to his role at Lush. He previously served as a client campaigner and GIS and data analyst for Greenpeace USA. And during his time there, Seth coordinated nonviolent direct actions, analyzed millions of records through environmental justice frameworks, and helped build a powerful movement infrastructure alongside coalitions like People versus Fossil Fuels. On this show, we explore what purpose-driven leadership looks like in practice. And Lush is a brand who keeps coming up in our conversations. Specifically, like the last three episodes, we always ask brands that we talk to who they look up to in the space. And we have gotten mentions of Lush from, I think, three of the last four companies that we've done episodes with. So we're really psyched to have you here. Today, we're going to talk with Seth about how he channels his background in social environmental justice into a growing network of customer advocates at a major retail brand, and what activism looks like for a practice for a company that refuses to treat purpose as a side initiative. Seth, welcome, man.
Thanks so much for having me. Psyched to be here with you.
Yeah. So who are you? Where do you live? And give us the 90 seconds on what Lush Cosmetics is all about.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'm Seth. I use he/him pronouns. I live on Lenape land, also known as Brooklyn, in New York. I grew up in the Hudson Valley and have been in the city for about 5 years now and joined the team at Lush a little bit over 3 years ago, helping lead mostly our in-store campaigning. So, you know, we say we'll work on issues anywhere from human rights, environmental justice, to animal protection. And the major way that shows up is with in-store initiatives where we bring a call to action to our customer base in partnership with a grassroots movement partner. So yeah, that's the gist of it.
So give me a dumbed down version of what that actually looks like in the wild. For those of us who are neither familiar with cosmetics or cosmetic retail, myself very much included, what do you mean when you say you're activating in-store? What does that actually look like?
Totally. So I mean, maybe you could imagine like what the store might look like heading into Valentine's Day, right? Where everything is pink, there's hearts, all the products are, you know, look like little chocolates, right? And the staff are approaching you and saying, hey, can we help you find, you know, a gift for your loved one ahead of this holiday, right? That's kind of standard, you know, everywhere in the mall looking like Valentine's Day. So what we'll do when we're running, you know, what we call an advocacy campaign is give that same treatment to an issue, to a call to action. So for example, earlier this year in March, we partnered with a number of immigrant rights organizations to bring a Know Your Rights campaign to our customers in the US. So all of our 200 shops across the country in their windows said, United in the fight for immigrant rights. We were distributing six different free booklets that covered a number of the issues that we're really seeing under threat and under attack right now in the US. And we had a limited edition fundraising product that called United Bath Bombs, shaped like a cute little house that's raising money for organizations at the grassroots level who are fighting for immigrant rights. So we kind of give the like full Lush treatment to, you know, a call to action. And we really like to focus on the issues that we see as being underrepresented or misrepresented kind of in the mainstream conversation, and invite, you know, folks in, you know, the communities where we have a presence into conversation around that to raise awareness and drive more people to take action.
That is very cool and so different than most of the folks that we are speaking with, where the kind of inflection point is often in marketing materials or web properties or whatever. And in your case, it's a lot of like face-to-face interaction that you guys are helping facilitate. I'm curious, how does that manifest itself with your staff? So when you guys are talking with your team members, they become the sort of face of the issue or the education of the issue. How do you guys go about even communicating to your team about the issue, activating them in a way where they can feel educated about the cause or the action or the values that you're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, whenever we do one of these campaigns, right, they usually go like 10 to 15 days. All of our staff become boots on the ground organizers and activists as part of that movement, right? And it's a ton of work getting ready, you know, to bring that messaging to life. It's pretty often where staff who are, you know, being asked is kind of part of their, like, the rest of the time, like, mostly normal retail job to talk about some of the biggest and more controversial issues going on in the world. And so we spend a lot of time doing training. We usually start the training, which I lead and develop internally, like 6 weeks ahead of every campaign. And I try and make as many different resources for our folks as possible. Lots of written materials. We do train the trainer calls. All the stores host team meetings where they go over all the materials together and practice what they're going to be saying to customers. But I think, you know, it comes up a lot where one of the advantages that we have as a business that has, you know, really always led with its values for, you know, now it's more than 30 years the business has been around. It's like the people generally who are coming into the stores are interested and receptive and glad to see those things in the places that they shop. And it also is kind of like the, like, inverse of door knocking or like street canvassing, where then your organizers are going to people, kind of going to their space to kind of enter their day and talk about something. Whereas we have people come to us, come to our, you know, four walls, into our space, and join us in conversation that way. So it's a lot of prep and practice in the lead up, and then kind of just, like, you know, being in normal conversation, right, with your friends and neighbors is usually how I try, you know, and get our staff to think about it, rather than like a super serious kind of like lecture series where you have to get everything right in every single moment.
Do you find that the types of employees that you guys get on your team are sort of self-selecting themselves into being naturally good at being advocates for these kinds of issues because they sort of know the Lush backstory as they come in the door? Or are they looking for any other job, like any other retail job, like the Sephora around the corner at the mall, and they just happen to pick you guys? How familiar with this ethos do you find your team members are before they start at the company?
That's a great question. I'll be upfront, I'm not involved with hiring at the retail level, so I'm not totally sure. But I do know that it really has an incredible impact on staff retention. We did actually a report last year with a great data firm where we had these 10 years of surveys that staff had been filling out following each of the campaigns with their expertise. They did their magic and found that people reporting that the campaigns, like 80% saying that the advocacy is a really big reason as to why they've stayed with the company. And, you know, I'll talk to, you know, especially some of our more engaged managers who have been around for a long time. They remember the first advocacy campaign that they did. They remember those amazing interactions that they've had with customers, or they remember the more difficult ones and really, you know, talk about how they grew after having those tough conversations. So I know that it's something that keeps people around and really makes it a lot of the time feel like more than a job. It's not normal, right? Like showing up to work and saying, hey, we're going to be paying you, right? Like, to have the main focus of your work for the next 2 weeks be standing up for immigrant rights while all around you, everything seems like all hope is lost. Like, that's a pretty big deal for folks.
Yeah, I would imagine it's something that the employees can kind of wear as a badge of honor, especially like a younger, typical retail kind of person that you might see, like the amount of pride they could have to be involved. This seems,
go to the store, they all have aprons and they're all covered in buttons. And so we'll do kind of like, you know, scout badges for some of the campaigns, the different buttons. And I'll go in, I'll be like, oh my God, that button, I wasn't even with the business. That's a button from 2016. Like, that's amazing that you still think about and you're still proud of the work that you did 10 years ago, right?
You guys have just reinvented flair as it comes to a corporate environment. So the folks at Chili's would be jealous. I'm curious. So, like I said, we had a couple folks from Ben & Jerry's and Brewgooder and Aspen. They all referenced Lush as being kind of a gold standard for embedding impact into a business. And I recognize that, you know, at a company this size of Lush, all different decisions are made at different levels. But I'm curious how you think about what Lush does really well that allows that to be the case. Like, what is the secret sauce that's maybe different than how other brands are impacting attempting to have impact, even if it's the ones who are kind of the other gold standards, right? Like, how do you guys think about it differently?
Totally. I mean, I would say this answer is maybe not that fair to folks who are at other places because, you know, it was really from the beginnings, right? So we have five founders. I like to call them British hippies. And the values and the mission were really embedded into the goals of the company from the start, right? So the foundational issue for Lush is fighting animal testing. And the founders' commitment to that actually predates Lush as it is. And a big part of why they wanted to start a brand like this was to prove that you could run a successful cosmetics company without ever testing on animals, without buying ingredients that were tested on animals, to really show that it's time to move beyond that industry-wide and you can make good and safe and useful products without doing so. And they found a lot of success with that and found that people were really receptive to taking action on that issue. And so then they started hiring activists, you know, one, to work on that, but then to also work on other things. They said, you know, if we can talk about this issue that people find to be controversial or don't really know about, why can't we talk about freedom of movement and immigrant rights? Why can't we talk about, you know, palm oil and deforestation around the world? And so it's been really embedded in what the business does the whole time. And so that means it's like part of the mandate for everybody, right? As much as you want to turn a profit because you're a company, they're, you know, Lush has its little sayings and its puns. And one of the main ones is we want to be leaving the world lusher than we found it. So I think the advocacy is a huge piece of that.
Yeah, it seems like one of the things we talk about here a lot is this intersection of, you know, purpose and profits. And, you know, I think you guys are another testament to the idea that they're not actually exclusive of each other, right? Like the Lush brand is known for its activism. That's pretty clear. And I think that creates brand equity and relationships with your customers that do end up creating longer term ROI. It just doesn't happen in a, you know, rewards program. It happens in a, hey, we give people something to be proud to spend their money with. It's a really neat way to think about it. I'm curious, as you guys have sort of evolved and changed, even in just in the last 5 years and the growth that you're seeing, where do you see the biggest sort of challenges when you're talking about the execution of these campaigns and understanding their impact? So what I mean by that is, like, you go in your case, right? You have to help a bunch of retail people understand an issue and be able to advocate for some type of action or education. How do you look at that and say, this was successful? Like, what success looks like? So let's use the immigrant rights example. How would you know you were successful?
Yeah, that is, I think, a question I think about a lot because, you know, our impact, right, is in all of those moments that people are having those conversations, right? So, you know, we can look at some KPIs, like we can look at how the email that went out to the marketing list performed. We can look at the app pop-up notification. Did people look at it? Did people click on it? We can look at the sales of the fundraising product that goes along with it. And I think all of that is great. And it points to, right, how it's being received in at the end of the day, what is like a pretty like small part of the overall impact, right? Like, you know, for example, if someone who's listening can help me figure this out, I'd love to figure out how much like the in-kind donation to an organization is when we put in all of our, you know, just in the US, 200 shop windows, their call to action, right? If they were to pay for that ad space, how much would that cost, right? And just the eyeballs of people walking through the mall who don't even go inside, right? Who like see that message and it plants even the tiniest seed in their head. I don't really know how to measure that, right? You know, the main tool I mentioned, right, is these surveys that we do with our shop managers after the campaign and try and keep it short, but really want them to share that qualitative data, right? What were your experiences like? What was the reception? Do you have any stories, you know, that really stood out for you? The great conversations or some difficult, you know, moments that you may have had and how you worked through them. And I nag them to fill it out. I just sent an email today. I said, hello, you 50 shops have yet to fill out my survey. Please, please do that. It's the way that we have to measure our impact. And even then, that's not really, right, like a full view into all of those micro interactions. So I think generally we kind of get a good sense of the overall reception and the overall staff experience, and as much as possible, try and keep track of and listen to the reactions and the responses and the feedback we're getting from our customer base and from the public. Because it's so in person, it's pretty tricky.
Yeah, I would assume that the retention question is very difficult to measure. Yes, there may have been a sale of $50 that came that was enhanced via somebody talking about an issue and maybe they bought the product. But the question is, did that get them to become a long-term customer? And how do you know when the advocacy was the way in the door? Seems like is the tough nut to crack.
Totally. And sometimes, you know, people will say that out loud to staff. You know, I think particular this past campaign, the designs and all of the different materials, we had the messaging in four languages. So it was in English, Spanish, Vietnamese, and Arabic. And in particular, had more than a handful of folks share back with us that people came into the store and said, hey, I came in because I just saw my language represented in your window and I'm with you guys forever. I love this message and I feel represented by it and I'm going to come and shop here. And I wasn't going to do that before. So, you know, every so often you get those folks who are like extroverted and wanting to say that out loud and share that with the staff. And so obviously that's like a really good data point. But, you know, we know, right, that the advocacy and the values are part of what we're delivering to our customers. It's part of the exchange, right? Where, you know, you come in and you shop and you get these wonderful products, absolutely. And you can get that with lots of other brands and businesses and retailers. And from us, you also get these other moments, right? To live your values and be in community and take action on issues that you maybe wouldn't have had the opportunity to otherwise, right?
So I'm going to ask the inverse of that question, which is, can you think of an example of a time where some feedback mechanism, whether it was data or qualitative in some form, led you to go, oh, man, this activation didn't hit as well as we wanted it to?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not totally sure. I'm going to think about it because I don't want to like cop out and be like, no, everything is perfect.
We bat 1,000 all the time.
Everything is perfect all the time. But, you know, generally you always find that like it's valuable in some way, right? And I really always find that the folks for whom it doesn't resonate are really in the minority. And I think especially when I'm talking to staff in the lead up to campaigns, folks, you know, it's like human nature to think more about what is possible and what is the worst case situation rather than focusing on what's actually going to be the most likely thing. And like, who are the people that we're really trying to reach? And that, you know, right side of the bell curve, that's the minority, maybe are going to come in and not show you a good time. 90, 75% of people are going to be receptive, or it's not going to bother them. Or then you get your other minority of folks who are super enthusiastic and really telling you what it means to them. I think that, you know, I wasn't with the business for a few of the campaigns and I think got more of a pushback. And I think in particular, a lot of the animal rights related issues have actually been a bit more controversial. Like I remember a lot of folks who have been with the business for a long time share that some of the more complicated conversations they had were with an anti-fur campaign that launched around the holidays and people getting really upset about saying what they can and can't buy and that sort of thing. But overall, generally, we pick issues that we know are going to mean something to people and we know are going to make a difference. And I haven't been very luckily part of something that's like totally backfired and made us regret, you know, working on it at all.
Yeah, well, it seems like maybe the missing piece is that tough nut to crack that we talked about before, where if you had an ability to sort of have a bit more specific understanding of some of the metrics about the activism impact and the versus the, you know, earned media out, you know, placements or the, you know, number of people who are in net new engaged in an issue that weren't before, like that would help you understand, well, this campaign, we drove 50,000 of those people and this campaign, we drove 28,000 or whatever, right? It's like the more complex issues like you guys are tackling in a really multivariate way, I think become really hard to quantify. And then when they're not easily quantified, it's really hard not only to tell what went well, but also just like, hey, maybe this went well and it felt great, but it didn't drive the impact that we did last year when we did a similar campaign or something. You know, it's a tough place to be. I'm curious, as you guys are thinking about issues, how do you decide and how far out in advance are you thinking about which issues you want to engage with over time? I mean, obviously the animal free and animal cruelty stuff is sort of seems like that's a through line throughout the existence of the company, but any other random issue, how do you guys decide that that's one you think you should have a voice in?
Totally. So I said before, but a big part of the mandate is like finding those issues that are misrepresented or underrepresented in like the mainstream conversation. We'll generally pick an issue 6 to 9 months in advance of one of our major campaigns. A fun part of my job is like we have a pretty extensive menu of different tactics that we'll leverage, right? And not everything we do is like, you know, an all systems go moment. And so, you know, for issues that we say we want to do something with, but don't need this major push right now, or we need to work on it sooner, we'll do, you know, different things as well. But generally, we need some sort of call to action issue that isn't going to be irrelevant in 6 to 9 months. And that isn't very volatile, right? We make a lot of print materials that then have to go out to all the stores, and we'll print things like 4 months generally before the campaign goes live. So, you know, if we think of a call to action that like might change 3 days before the campaign and all of the stores already have all their signage and everything, that's not going to be good. So, you know, tend to need something that like is specific and actionable and tangible, but can kind of last a long time. And also that will actually like be supported and uplifted by a really wide reach of audience. I think a great example that again predates me, but in 2017, the brand did a campaign in the US about abolishing the death penalty, and got connected with the folks in that space. It just so happened right after they had finished a big narrative messaging research project. And so what they were able to do with the campaign was integrate all of the messages that they found were the most successful, right, in their trials, into the campaign training, into all of the materials, all of the language and all of the goals throughout. And then it kind of just like let that whole coalition do this big like field test of, okay, we did these focus groups, we did these surveys, we did all of these, you know, kind of more traditional approaches. And now we get to see like how it lands with the normal people who are like going to the mall.
How's it going to land with the folks at the mall? You know, it's a question that doesn't get asked very often.
Right. And that's generally who you really want to be moving on, like big issues that are really heavy and really emotional and like really divide people and like are as untouchable as the death penalty. That's a really important moment. And I don't really think that would have been like a good campaign for Lush if that coalition didn't have that type of material for us to then leverage and implement. And I think everybody really knew like the strength there is the conversations. And in this moment, if this movement, this issue needs those conversations to drive it forward, then that's really the sweet spot. And that's really like the value that we can deliver, you know, on an issue to a movement, to an organization.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, and it's interesting, we heard this from Chris Miller, who runs advocacy at Aspen. He was basically saying, you know, we're not trying to be the leading voice in any issue. We want to find issues that people we can partner with. There's coalitions, there's organizations, there is movement that we can use our voice to amplify. And it sounds like you guys are similar in your approach to partnering with people that sort of have already been walking the walk for a while, and you can serve as a way to boost what they're doing.
Totally. I mean, you know, I started at Greenpeace. That was like my first jobs were at Greenpeace. And I always like to think of Greenpeace kind of like PR for the planet, with like kind of, you know, I really felt like as a campaigner there, we had two main like tools in our hands. One was a magnifying glass where we could bring big attention to a local, small, issue really working with frontline communities, bring attention to something that's not getting its visibility. And then we had the megaphone, right, to uplift those voices from those people, from that forest, from that ocean to the main stage. And I think that Lush is similar. We're not the experts. We're just trying to channel these messages and these calls to action through the assets that we have, right? These stores, like on main streets and malls, our staff who are getting paid to like learn about and talk about this issue, the value of having a brand, a corporate voice, like endorse the work, right, that you as an organization or as a movement are doing. We're not the experts, right? We're helping bring that to life and kind of saying, here are all these things that we can do like for you and with you. Like, does this make sense? Is this going to help you? And if yes, let's do it. And sometimes folks say no, like actually, that's not what we need in our work right now, like maybe in the future. And so it'll be like, we really want to take on this issue, but actually, like, we wouldn't be an asset to them in this moment. So then we won't.
Yeah, I would assume it's almost like when you think about it that way, you guys, I could see how an issue as dense as a lot of the issues you guys advocate for, right? The death penalty, refugee rights, you guys are, you're a cosmetics brand. Like, who are you to be talking up about the, you know, the death penalty? And I think it seems like your guys' track record over time and being able to tailor your approach to these issues and not being kind of universal is maybe what builds a little bit of trust with these organizations that like, yeah, yeah, we don't want to just sell more makeup or more bath bombs. Like, we're here to help with this issue and we can do it with an authentic voice because of the way that we do it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because, you know, we wouldn't take on an issue that like we don't believe in. The kind of like framework for Lush's ethics is actually called the We Believe statement. And, you know, a lot of it is kind of product or kind of like culture related, but campaigning is a big part of what makes Lush Lush and is actually a requirement, right? For all of the different markets of the business and all of the different companies. Everybody is required to do at least one advocacy initiative a year. And if you don't, then I don't fully understand like the business and joint venture sorts of terms, but if you don't do it, then I know that you're in violation to that. And so it's really baked in and really a core part of the ethics and what the business believes in.
I want to turn it a little bit to your personal journey here. You came from Greenpeace, right? And I'm curious, what were your misconceptions or what do you think the common misconceptions are for people transitioning from a real, like, we're Greenpeace, we're taking on the planet, we're going to, you know, get the oil ships with our banners on it and all the things to like a corporate brand who's got to make a profit and they got to sell a thing. What surprised you about that switch? What did you get wrong or where were your assumptions off in terms of like what that would be like when you're coming from as sort of values-centric as Greenpeace?
Totally. I would say the main two things may not be widely applicable. However, the first one was actually how the resourcing was so different, right? Like at a nonprofit, you're really focused on donors and grants. And, you know, maybe you get a grant and it has to be used in this way and you have to be doing all of this reporting. Where at Lush, we've got a budget and we use it. And because the business overall and leadership is so supportive of it, I really felt like, wow, I actually have more resources now, right? Both on like the dollar signs and then, you know, like we've been talking about all of the different kind of tangible things that the business has that's part of the advocacy work. And then the other one, and again, I think this is quite specific, is I really feel like I have so much more freedom to be bold and say kind of the cutting edge things and be more nimble in the communications and the actions that we get to take than my experience at Greenpeace, which I think is really mainly because my entire time at the organization, the energy transfer lawsuit had been like, you know, right in the thick of it. And so that slap suit against Greenpeace has really limited the ways that the organization has been able to like be on the front lines in a lot of different ways. It's really put Greenpeace on the front lines of those corporate attacks on free speech and the right to protest. But as a campaigner, especially starting out in my career, it was very complicated legally and we'd have lots of things with all of the lawyers all the time about what we should be saying and what not and what makes sense and how do we protect, you know, our staff and the organization and the people that we work with. while moving things forward and still doing everything we can. And so kind of coming out of that sort of situation, like being in the middle of a lawsuit into a place that's not in that context and like really intentionally tries to say like the most controversial things and take on those hard issues was really fun and like a really big shift for me for sure.
You know, I sense that at a personal level, like, you know, your connection and output often comes through kind of narrative and storytelling and thinking about how to get these messages to the people that you're trying to, you know, activate. In your case, it happens to be a lot of internal folks. Now, what do you think you have learned about the tactics or effectiveness of different sort of storytelling or narrative? You know, what works for you in terms of like getting people to connect and how have you sort of thought about that in the last couple of years?
Totally. I think something that I really try and remember as much as I can is that people want to do good things, right? And if you come into especially these conversations around the issues that, you know, most people wouldn't touch with the 10-foot pole and most companies wouldn't touch with a 100-foot pole, remembering that people want to learn about what's going on in the world and like want to be part of doing something good and, you know, creating that opportunity and like reducing that friction and like bringing it to people in that way. It's like just generally makes it easy at the end of the day and to like lead with those shared values and like see the good in other people and, you know, especially for our staff, like, as a way to connect with people in their community beyond that like salesperson, customer person relationship has been a big thing, which is hard to hold on to sometimes, right? Like when you look at the news, I have to look at the news a lot when, you know, we have to read some of the meaner emails that people will send in through our customer care team when they're not loving the things that we're doing. Remembering that at the end of the day, most of the people like want to be doing these good things has been a big lesson. And it's like, okay, but like, you know, what is really the most common type of reaction, most common type of person that we're getting to engage with, like is landing in that camp.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the lessons that you see from all the brands who do this really well is clear alignment that like, it can't work for everybody. Meaning like if the message hits with literally 100% of people, then it's not a good message, right? It's like, totally. Do you like puppies? Yep, we got a 99%, you know,
hey,
approval.
You might
on that.
Not get that. There's some.
That's true. I'm sure there's.
She's not in the government anymore, but I think some.
She might be running a dog kennel for all we know.
I hope not.
So I think, you know, as you're thinking through it, where do you think that ability to kind of balance a brand that can still have fun and can still be seen as inclusive and supportive, but also be talking about some super heavy stuff. How do you think that Lush manages to kind of keep both of those plates in the air?
I mean, no matter what issue we're going to be talking about, it's going to be surrounded by like glitter and sparkle and bath bombs. So it's got to fit in that way, right? And like match the brand voice, which is like cheeky and playful and full of puns and like bright and inviting. And that is a great way to like bring people into something that in any other circumstance, like would have been super uncomfortable. Over here, you're going to get a hand massage. And over here, you're going to talk about climate justice. And then over here, they're going to demo a sparkly bath bomb for you. Like that whole customer experience like has to make sense. And in a big way, it makes sense because it's what Lush is always doing and it's part of the brand. But the brand voice and tone that we get to use really lends itself to that, right? Like using humor, using that playfulness helps take people's defenses down and makes them more comfortable. And I think that's a big part of why it's so effective. And if we didn't do it that way, like wouldn't feel good. It wouldn't feel right. It wouldn't like look right in the store either. Always the campaigns like are colorful and like use cool fonts. We've got amazing designers that I get to work with on all the different campaigns who are using incredible visual storytelling to like draw people in again within the surround of like glitter and sparkles and bath bombs and like the Willy Wonka situation we've got, making it stand out but fit in overall is a big part of what makes it super fun as well.
Yeah, it would seem like the joy and playfulness kind of carries through, and that
allows you to kind of balance some serious stuff with slightly more lighthearted purchases and customer retention and all the things. So that's really neat. I am curious, as you think about where your mechanisms for telling stories has evolved and will evolve as Lush brand, right? Like, you know, you're talking about a lot of in-store experiences. Has there been any changes to how you've seen either the in the tactical work that you're doing or like Lush as a whole in terms of like how they're changing the technology that is used to connect with your, you know, best customers or your best advocates or your best Earth Justice Warriors? Like what is the landscape of just like the tactics and tools? How has that changed over the last 18 months or so for you?
Not in the last 18 months, but a huge one is that Lush hasn't been on the major social media platform since 2021, right? So the business, after the Facebook files came out, decided that, you know, Meta, TikTok, Snapchat weren't safe places, right, to be. Not bringing our customers into those spaces, right? It became really important to the business. So we left. So that's a space where we're not in, where like everybody else is, and is such a big tool for communication in the world. It's not like the foremost tool. And so, you know, shifting that focus to like being in real life, I think right now people are really coming around to that idea. And like, we've already been there, right? And so as people are saying, like, we need to get off our phones, we need to escape the algorithm, we need to be outside and be connecting in real life with each other more, like that's where we've been and what we've been doing. We've also, you know, in my time at the business, been trying to do more like activations outside of our stores and you meet the people who are not already in our universe in the places we don't have a shop or, you know, where something important is happening. How can we develop the same types of experiences that people would get when they come to Lush and engage with one of our issues, but somewhere else? And so that's been really fun, trying to like figure that out and find the right places and meet the right people who can develop those experiences, like, you know, activation type events in collaboration, but really focusing on that being people together in real life, in connection in that way, I would say is the biggest thing. That's like kind of the opposite of like how we use technology, if that makes sense.
Well, no, I think that in a lot of ways, there's somewhere in there, there's a metaphor of like the engagement that you're looking for is literally not a data point, right? Like it's an actual human being engaging with another human being. That's what the engagement rate should be based on, not did they keep their mouse moving enough on this particular social media post or whatever, right? Like you guys have been able to think about it differently because of the restrictions that you place on yourselves about what channels you feel authentic to use or not. So it's really, really neat. I'm simultaneously super jealous of just the general idea of a brand who has no social footprint. And also as a person who loves data, like, well, then what are we talking about? You know, there's no data to look at. I got to assume email becomes a huge part of what your relationship with your customers looks like. How do you guys think about email and your web property when you're talking about these activism and advocacy initiatives? And I guess I'll be a little bit more specific because you're often using partners, right? When you guys think about your customers and the ones who are engaging with advocacy or activism or any of the things, are they Lush customers and then there's a separate silo where they are activists who get pushed off to a partner? Or are they, do you guys think about them as sort of one group, right? Like customers / activists are the people who you guys are maintaining your email list inclusive of, your website visitors, all that.
Yeah, I would say it's like one group. You'll have to have Fabio come on and talk more about segments and an email strategy and all of those great juicy questions. But I will say the main thing that we end up using the website and the email for is supporting the sales of our giving products, right? So we'll have products that are raising money for the different issues that we campaign on. Really, the site is designed and the email base is designed around sales and pushing sales. And so we really find that when we're centering those giving products, that works. And that generally those folks like are not the most receptive to like sign this petition or read this article. It's just not really who's in that ecosystem. And so that's something that folks will come not a ton to us to ask for of like, hey, will you blast this out on your email? And usually what I'll say is like, I can, but we could do it in the store instead. And like, you'll actually end up with this instead of like,
yeah,
sure, it'll go to 3 million people, but most of them won't look at it when actually, you know, I really know I can deliver you more value if we do it in this other way.
Yeah, it's really neat. All right, I'm going to hit the quick fire section of our interview as we wrap up here. So what brand or could be an organization do you look up to other than Lush?
I know you've hosted a few of the folks I would generally say.
We have to tell people they can't say Patagonia anymore.
I don't know the folks at Patagonia at all, actually. So, you know, I'll say instead the folks at Seventh Generation, I think in the past have done a lot of really amazing work. Kate Ogden, who really built out their advocacy and movement building whole program. A few years ago, they got involved with the NY Renews campaign to support the Build Public Renewables Act. It did an amazing job of like bringing, you know, a business, a private sector voice to support that work. And it was super impactful. And yeah, definitely feel really inspired by Kate and the types of ways that they will leverage, you know, the tactics and the tools that they have.
I happen to know Kate and I agree. She's very inspirational. So that's great. What do you wish you could measure?
I would love to find a way to measure like how much we move people, right, along the kind of sliding scale of support, right? Like, how often are we taking people from a 4 to a 5 or from a 7 to an 8 or from a 1 to a 10? That's super hard to measure. I know lots of organizations spend a lot of time trying to figure out the best ways to do that. And I wish that, yeah, we could figure that out.
What do you do, you know, post super heavy activation where you've just been getting your ass kicked for 6 weeks or 6 months leading up to it and you've been doing all the trainings and taking all the feedback forms? Like, how do you refill your tank and your energy levels to keep fighting the good fight?
I love reading. I really read only fiction as like total escape, like into, I love sci-fi. I love like climate fiction. I'll read like a fantasy book every once in a while. And I really find that just totally takes my brain out of the world and into something else and really inspires my imagination, which is a huge part of work as well.
It leads into our next question, which is what book or podcast do you find yourself recommending most to others?
One of my favorite podcasts is totally unrelated generally to what I do, which is called Maintenance Phase. It's awesome. They debunk like moral panics and health, like misconceptions and pyramid schemes. And they are super funny. It's super well researched. And it's something I, you know, never really thought about before, but I love that podcast.
Nice.
Yeah.
If I was coming to Brooklyn, where would you send me to get the best sandwich?
The best sandwich. There's a place pretty close to me called Brooklyn Hero, where they do kind of those like classic giant sandwiches that are actually 2 or 3 meals. So I'd send you there.
And what would your normal order be at said sandwich shop?
I get something different every time, but I am pretty partial to like one of those like fried chicken sandwich situations.
Like cutlet scenario? Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. They're on every menu now, which is great for me. Then I don't have to think so hard about what I'm ordering.
That's great. Well, we really appreciate you guys as a brand and you specifically for being here. So where can people go to follow more about your work personally or Lush's campaigns or any specific campaign you're working towards?
Yeah, I mean, LinkedIn is really one of the only platforms that the business is on right now. So I would say, you know, this is a businessy podcast, so that's a good spot.
Huge on LinkedIn, Lush yeah. Cosmetics. Well, that's great. We'll put a link to the episode. Seth Laxman, expert in public affairs, social environmental justice, advocacy campaigner for Lush Cosmetics. Seth, we appreciate you being here, man.
Thanks so much for having me, Neil.